There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
The only thing better than grinding all night for your side hustle is your roommate picking you up with Mickey D's breakfast. The perfect pickup deal.
There's a deal for every morning at McDonald's.
Right now, taste breakfast perfection when you get a warm and savory sausage McMuffin with egg for just $2.50. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with combo meal.
Hello, my name is Dave Hanratty and there will be no encore. Welcome to a very, very special episode of the No Encore Music Podcast. It's the revisit once again, in which we go back in time to Irish albums from the years between 1980 and 2005. It's an even more special episode because I'm currently smothered with a head and chest cold, so I sound pretty awful. Joining me as always is Kieran McGuinness from De Laurentiis. How are you, sir?
I'm very good, thank you.
Good.
I don't have a cold, though.
You look great, though. You sound great. it's a journalist slash DJ heavy table this week. We have Niall Byrne, aka Niall Nine.
How's it going? How are you?
I'm good, man.
Good.
Nadine O'Regan.
Hi.
Hello.
did he get your name right?
He did.
And we have Dan Hegarty.
I'm not going to ask you how you are because I know you're fine. And you don't sound so you've had cold at all. So yeah.
Thanks. I'm kind of easing into it. What year is it, Kieran?
It's 1985.
All right.
And it was the year that Gorbachev, I'll ask him how he pronounces his name. Gorbachev takes over the USSR, We Are the World. It was the middle of the charity things, so loads of charity stuff. Sally Field did the embarrassing speech, you know, you love me, you really love me. Born in the USA, best song ever with two chords. And he has two chords. It was released and massive. Various other things, Martina Navratilova won loads of stuff. Who was the music albums of the year?
Well, big albums that year were included Kate Bush, Hounds of Love, Phil Collins, No Jacket Required, of course, Run DMC, King of Rock, Whitney Houston's debut, The Smiths, Meet His Murder, Tears for Fears, Songs from the Big Chair, and Grace Jones, Island Life, among others.
So Run DMC, King of Rock, that was...
second album.
It's tricky and all that kind of stuff.
I think so, yeah.
I listened to the whole thing.
Really?
Amazing. I was singing, it's tricky. I'm not going to do it now.
I don't want to derail the podcast already, but we're all Phil Collins fans at the table, right? I mean...
I'm totally a Phil Collins fan after years of denial. I'm absolutely a Phil Collins fan.
I am wearing my studio sweatpants.
I was about to say, studio is a banger.
I saw that recently at a covers gig, and I was like, who is this? This is brilliant. And it was...
Yeah. Of course it's brilliant. It's Phil Collins.
Our club light Numo is basically built on the foundation that there are Phil Collins songs that should be played on every night. And that's kind of how we operate, really. Like Sussudio or Easy Lover or even In the Air Tonight. You know, I mean, there's so many actual great chat. I think the problem with Phil Collins is he's a bit of a nonce. You know, he's a bit of an annoying dude.
Is it true that he used to ring up journalists who gave him bad reviews and give out to them?
That would sound... He does look like the kind of man who would do that.
I would not like to be given out to by Phil Collins.
I don't know if you've seen now, he's back in his reunion phase and he was on, I think, Jimmy Fallon there about a month ago.
Yeah. Well, he has a new memoir. Yeah.
He looks like the cranky man in the pharmacy. He totally looks like he's like, he forgot his prescription and and they won't give it to him and he's just like, fuck's sake. I really, like, I need this for my drumming, you know. Like,
I'm going to talk to your manager.
Yeah.
I can only imagine that.
And the name of that memoir?
I think it's called Not Dead Yet.
It is, which is the name of his tour.
Do I win a prize?
Yeah. You get two tickets to Not Dead Yet by Phil Collins.
So that's setting the bar pretty low. He's like, you know, unless he's like a corpse on stage, you're getting something out of it.
Well, we won't be talking about
him.
Yeah,
but contrary to what was sort of on record for a while, apparently he did not send a fax to his wife.
I was going to say divorce his wife by
fax. So he's argued that point. I think he sent a fax to iron out some of the finer details of their divorce, but it was erroneously reported in the press that that was how he decided to break up with her.
But we're living in a post-fact world now.
Who cares?
Yeah,
yeah, he faxed.
Divorce. I've never sent a fax to anybody.
I've sent faxes.
Really? Years ago,
yeah. Contracts.
I still send faxes.
For fun.
Really?
Yeah.
Just for fun.
Just for fun, yeah.
Yeah, just pick random numbers and just go for it.
Please tell you to stop doing this stuff.
Well, we'll probably get into our shortlist now, I guess.
Let's talk more about faxes. Just forget about it.
Okay. Another tough shakedown, Ciara.
Yeah, actually a big tie as well, but we got through it through Nadine's choosing of Paul Brady. But we had The Blades, Last Man in Europe. We have Micro Disney, The Clock Comes Down the Stairs. We have Paul Brady, Back to the Centre, Blue in Heaven, All the God's Men, and finally The Golden Horde with The Chocolate Biscuit Conspiracy. So that's our five albums for this year.
And what didn't make it out of high-profile contention?
Well, it's funny actually. There was a lot of trad albums, like really big trad albums, like Moving Hearts. They had a huge trad album this year. Clannad, because when I was researching the year, I went on. There's a best albums or whatever, and you just click on the little Irish flag for the year, and it goes through all the kind of releases that were kind of international from the year, and there was nine. This year, and the top rated one by aggregate scores was Clannad's Macalla album, and I was thinking, oh, that's definitely going to get in. And
then In a Lifetime with Bono on it,
which is
a great song, in fairness.
But it didn't make it. I was surprised that one didn't make it in. But you were thinking,
I was kind of surprised the second album by the Pogues didn't make it in. What's it called?
Rum, Sodomy and the Lash.
Rum, Sodomy and the Lash. That's the one.
Did get votes. It just didn't get through the time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I actually really enjoyed going back to listen to that. So I got something out of it.
Yeah. That's the second.
Nobody
album,
else did.
Huh? I think that's the second album.
Second album. Yeah, yeah. It has Dirty Old Town on it, and. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. Do you know what it reminded me of? It was like one of those albums where you kind of listen to it and you're like, if I was living in London now, I'd be listening to this all the time. You know, yeah. There's loads of references to London. There's loads of, you know, it does place it. I think it's a really nice distillation of what the Pogues were really good at.
To some extent, though, I thought that one of the reasons maybe broadly that we arrived at the selection we arrived at is, and maybe this is a controversial point, but a lot of the bands that we're talking about, if not all of them, could be conceived in some way as having failed to really break the mainstream or failed to achieve the goals that they set out for themselves. So even though Paul Brady is in there, he still talks about how he feels like he didn't get to the status of maybe some other people, like, say, Elton John or whatever. You know, if you read back through interviews, you'll see that. And The Blades are certainly a really good example of a band that could and should have been bigger. Micro Disney, Blue in Heaven. Like, you're looking at these bands going, well, there's actually a lot of bands here who could have been bigger. And the thing for me about The Pogues and Van Morrison, in a strange way, is I've already kind of sat with those albums years ago and kind of grappled with what they're doing and seen whether I'm into it or not. So in some ways, going back to like Micro Disney, a band that like I should have known more about but didn't, was actually more interesting.
I actually asked loads of people that I met in the last week. I take the dog for a walk in Dublin into a park, and a lot of people I go to the park with are of an older age than me and would be more familiar. And anytime I mentioned any of the albums, they were like, oh yeah, it never quite worked out, you know, that kind of way. There was a lot of that talk from these bands, particularly The Blades and Blue in Heaven, were mentioned in that regard, and The Golden Horde to a lesser extent.
Well, let's kick it off with you then, Ciarán, shall we?
My album that I'm saying is Blue in Heaven, All the God's Men.
Oh, it's Blue in Heaven. Yes. Again, this is his favourite band of all time.
Okay, well, I don't know about that, but actually, I was really surprised by this album. So this is Dublin Four Police from Churchtown, apparently, and they were signed to Mother Records. That's Bono on the Edge's, I think, label.
Yeah.
And this is their first album, All the God's Men, recorded by Martin Hannett from Factory Records. So that's, you know, Joy Division, everything from Joy Division up to...
Is it Depeche Mode?
I don't know. I that's what I thought of. First time I heard his name, I thought he did Depeche Mode. He might have. He also did.
You know what? I think it was actually New Order.
He did New Order, I think, definitely. And he also did, you know, everything up to Happy Mondays. So, like, there's quite a, you know, diverse kind of amount of stuff in that, but it's very like U2. It's very like the Smiths. He sounds like Morrissey a lot, and it's kind of dark indie pop or something, that kind of buzz. And I got a real surprise by it. It's very moody, it's very atmospheric. It's got a lot of good stuff in it. It's very produced now, I suppose. And the first track on it, Sometimes, is a brilliant song. It's absolutely great. I really, really love it. And I think I just kind of gave the album more of a chance as a result of kind of listening to that. Now, I will say there's loads of, you know, as I say, Smiths in it, but there isn't the lyrics of Smiths. You know, there's lots of U2 in it, and there isn't sort of the, I don't know, the kind of connective thing that U2 have on every album. There isn't that. It's like just under the level of all those kind of things. There's a lot of Joy Division in there as well, but that's kind of the bass just sounds like, loads of the bass sounds like that.
Did you think of the Horrors? Because I started thinking of the Horrors.
Yeah, that's a good shout.
Yeah, yeah, no, I didn't think of the Horrors, but now you say it, yeah. But I think there's something about the way that, it's kind of, the low ends are really boosted and all that kind of stuff. But
yeah, I mean, that's, to me, that album is the authentic version of all those, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, where a lot of albums were coming out like that sounded a bit like that, like the Horrors, even Girls' Names to a lesser extent. And those albums certainly, maybe, were inspired by albums like this, you never know, or artists like this.
Well, it's kind of intriguing, I think, because like I've never heard of this band whatsoever, like, and I was surprised because it's much more polished and kind of accomplished than a lot of, you know, a lot of bands that have come since, I suppose.
It is an interesting thing, though. I mean, like the names that you guys mentioned there, like I think some of the records, even though we've encountered so far doing this, sound very dated and like sound trapped. They sound very much like this is so off its time that it actually is kind of cringy to listen to here and there. But this kind of drowned in reverb thing and just that kind of, you know, like almost indecipherable at times holds up today because the shoegaze thing is still quite prevalent and there's lots of bands that kind of do it very, very well. So in that regard, I found this quite palatable to go back to. But at the same time, kind of going with what Nadine was saying earlier on, I do feel like a lot of the bands on this list, you can see why they didn't become world beaters and you can see why they didn't really break out too much.
If there were other bands like this around at the time, they would have had to do more to stand out in those terms. Mm-hmm. Certainly that's how I felt. I enjoyed the album, but I also felt that it was lacking in something that would have lifted it above other albums or made it a bit more memorable.
You often wonder though what the production at the time, what that did, how that changed the songs. Did it change them that much? And I guess you'd only really know if you were actually going to see them regularly, because like Blue in Heaven went on to be the Blue Angels, changed quite a lot, got a lot more mainstream. That like songs like Get It Back, Candy and stuff like that that actually did crack Irish radio anyway, but this is a different thing altogether.
Yeah, it's funny because I mean, this is going to sound like the most faint praise that you could ever give anyone, but I've written down pleasant listen.
Ah, oh, that's harsh.
But the thing about it is that's kind of what I thought. Like, I could listen to this, like you said, palatable. Like, it was kind of easy to listen to, like, you know, and that's because of the production. But you made a point about the reverb, and that's one of the songs, I think it's the last track, Slowly, and first of all, it sounds like Morrissey all the way through, which is just a bit mad how much it sounds like. But that's supposed to be like, you know, gentle and this kind of like, you know, affecting song. But the reverb and all that kind of stuff, it kind of makes it kind of distances it a little bit, I think, from the listener, you know. I think there's a little bit of that like throughout the album. And as you said, it's just missing something to put it into the like, and I'd push it across the line into great. But I think it's good. So actually, I was really surprised that it actually got into this, because I was like,
I really liked it. It was one of my favourites of the bunch, and it was the one that I'd probably pluck out today and want to put on Spotify or a CD player, just because it feels to me of a piece with the kind of work that bands that obviously came after Blue in Heaven have been releasing over the past few years, whether you're talking about Interpol or Editors or the Horrors. There's that sense of sort of a swathe of fog or something curling around the guitars. Like, it's as though there's a little space between the band maybe and the audience, and it's very sort of atmospheric, and I love that about it. And I do think there's more passion in this record as well than there is, funnily enough, in the Micro Disney record, because that one seems a bit more detached and sardonic, and I actually get more of the Morrissey qualities of Micro Disney, funnily enough, than I do off Blue in Heaven.
Okay, yeah.
And I loved the feeling of coming to this and really knowing very little about them and thinking, this is really cool. I would totally listen to this in 2016.
I mean, so you said this, Dan, that they went on to form another band, the Blue Angels. I mean, did you see them live? Or?
Yeah, Yeah, I would have seen them a couple of times. They released another album after this called Explicit Material.
Yeah, I saw that, the Blue in Heaven. Yes.
But no, the Blue Angels were a little bit different. I suppose a little bit more palatable, a little bit more straightforward. I think it was more focused on the songs. Also, it was 7 or 8 years on as well. So, the styles, production values had changed. So they were essentially, some of the same people in the band, but a different band, if you know what I mean. Yeah.
Well, they were also completely dyed blonde.
I saw the video footage and I was like, oh my God, they don't look at all like what I thought they were going to look like.
Yeah, they didn't either. And the singer looks like...
He's so happy.
Yeah. But as well, like, sometimes you watch bands now, like, you watch bands with the hindsight of, 2016 or whatever. And I was looking back at the video and I just thought the singer looked really unlikely, to be kind of this kind of emotive kind of singer, not that
he's
isn't.
Pretty close to Howard Jones, who actually released was it Dream Into Action in the same year?
Maybe.
In my opinion.
No idea.
You don't remember Howard Jones?
No, I remember Howard Jones. I like to get to know you well. Yeah, walking around shaking people's hands. Big hair, yeah. I aspire to it sometimes, accidentally. But I suppose, yeah, with him, he's had an interesting career. He went on to form Dirt Records that release albums by Revelino, Sack, Butterfly Effect, which is an outstanding record, The Idiots, loads of stuff like that. So he's been immersed in music for a long time, Shane O'Neill.
That's right, yeah, Shane O'Neill, yeah. And that's interesting that he's connected to all those people. And also, that Mother Records, I can imagine, The Edge and Bono in their new Apple-like Beatles, office. They're like, let's sign some bands. I can imagine going out and like them as musicians signing loads of bands that wouldn't sell records.
Well, it's funny. Niall was talking about the Golden Horde earlier on. Their real album that they put together, their self-titled album, came a number of years later, and that was on Mother Records. And it's actually a really solid album. It's a really, really good album. I'm trying to think of the year,
1990. Yeah.
And Golden Horde, Endless Weekend, Friends in Time, and probably the best tune, 100 Boys. Oh, yeah.
100 Boys.
Well, which is still a brilliant tune.
Well, do you want to do the Golden Horde next then?
Sure. We can move into the Golden Horde now.
Sure.
And we'll have this what they sound like right here. We're gonna turn it upside down, the whole world upside down, upside down, upside down. Golden Horde, a terrific, terrific album title, The Chocolate Biscuit Conspiracy. And Niall, you're...
Unfortunately, it does remind me a little bit of a certain Limp Bizkit title, but we won't go there.
Wayward Youth. Sorry.
Well, Starfish Chocolate Water or something.
Yeah, whatever. So the Golden Horde's album, The Chocolate Biscuit Conspiracy.
I knew it. I could tell by it.
What does that mean?
Okay.
Let's
sorry, guys. I shouldn't have brought a Limp Bizkit up. I'm really sorry. Yeah.
Biggest Limp Bizkit fan in the world.
You with your baseball hat on backwards.
Yeah,
that's
right. And my gang signs. My choreographed dancers dressed the same. Yeah, it's all good. Sorry, Niall. Please rescue us.
So The Chocolate Biscuit Conspiracy, it's kind of a punk album with some garage and surf rock influences. As far as I know, it was their first kind of release officially. It's kind of a cross between the Ramones and the B-52s. I know we were listening to the YouTube version of the album, and it's very crackly and very lo-fi, but I kind of enjoyed it for that. I actually really enjoyed that aspect of it.
Same.
What I really liked about it as well, it was that it was a lot of fun. The other part of it was, I wasn't even sure if you even figure out it was an Irish band. There was really no references. It's very enthralled to American pop culture. There's a lot of references to conspiracy theories in it. So we got like Lee Harvey Oswald, UFOs, song called Communist for the FBI, references to the Marx Brothers and the actor Larry Talbot, amongst other things. And there's also some spoken word features from the American author Robert Anton Wilson, who lived in Dublin at the time and the band brought in. So yeah, I really enjoyed it. Like I said, it wasn't very serious. It seemed like a total good buzz. I'm not sure. I hadn't heard any about this before, but actually, in the context of talking to a few people, the name Simon Carmody came up quite a lot when I mentioned it first. So he seemed to be very well known around that time.
I really enjoyed it. The first track I think is the weakest track. I think it kind of lets it down a bit, because I think it is it's much more interesting than the first track, because if you just listen to that, it's just so throwaway, you know?
Yeah.
But the rest of it is kind of like a mix of throwaway and interesting, you know?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I kind of felt,
but that. That's what I felt like. It was like a cross between the Ramones and the B-52s. It was something.
The B-52s. It felt like
it was
the
something
guy.
Something like that. Yeah.
It sounded like the guy from the B-52s solo album. I was expecting to shout Love Shack at some point.
Yeah.
But your man Robert Alan Wilson, the future.
I love the B-52s.
I absolutely adore the B-52s as well.
I don't mind the B-52s. Tin roof rusted. That is what she is saying.
And actually, a tin roof rusted. And at the end of one of the songs, he says something like that. I can't remember.
he
just says something that sounds like that. But the way that the melody goes in Everybody's Talking About the Chocolate Biscuit, it sounds exactly like Everybody's Talking About the Stormy Weather by Sonic Youth, you know, which is Teenage Riot, started Teenage Riot. Okay, and I was going, that sounds so much like it. And then I checked, and they played with Sonic Youth, and I definitely think now that Sonic Youth stole it, because it sounds so similar. Right. But you know what I mean? Everybody's talking about the stormy weather. The start of, you know, anyway, everybody's talking about the chocolate biscuit.
You're going to get so sued, man. You're going to get so sued.
Definitely not getting sued. But anyway, a bit of Sonic Youth in there randomly as well.
Yeah, I just really enjoyed it. What do you guys think, other than that? Any other thoughts?
There's a brilliant version of the chocolate biscuit live at HMV Unplugged. From years later, and it's hilarious. It kind of borders on pantomime, but it's supposed to. They're having a bit of a laugh, I don't know if you could say he berates the crowd, but he gives out to them for being not as lively as they might do. They were just one of those really underrated bands. Like, I put them up right up there with Sultans of Ping and people like that. They were a super band. They went on after this to be managed by Ian Wilson, who produced me for a long time, real gentleman. But the other thing is, the Fanning session that they did that year or the year after, I've repeated a couple of times, but requested by people. And when I've bumped into any of the band, particularly Simon, and I mentioned this to him, he seems absolutely bewildered at why anyone would be in any way interested in the band anymore. And it's like, because you had some really good tunes, that's why.
But it's striking, if you look on SoundCloud, there's a huge number of songs from the Golden Horde that are actually have never been released. They're all just demo versions.
Yeah, there's a 56-track compilation of the rarities on Bandcamp. And 41 of them are on SoundCloud, apparently. So
he's got a solo album that never came out either. But anyway, that's another thing.
I was talking to somebody about the Golden Horde, and they said their first contact with them was actually Stephen Malcolmus and the Jicks gig in Dublin, where the band played a Golden Horde cover, and they were all pleased with themselves, and they were like, it was like, and nobody reacted, and it was like, do you not guys not know the Golden Horde? And it was like, because nobody in the crowd knew who they were.
Jeez,
but that's the interesting thing about this podcast, especially, you know, you've got a lot of albums that maybe, you know, they might be on CD somewhere, they might exist in different places, but it's kind of hard to find them. In the end, it looked like there was not a lot of the stuff about the Golden Horde, but there actually was quite a lot, just not a lot of the music. There's a blog spot that looks really active and has a load of videos on YouTube as well. Like I said, the Bandcamp stuff was there. Facebook page as well. So there's loads of things out there about the band.
Do they remind anyone else slightly of the Ramones?
Yeah. Big time.
It's like the Ramones mixed with kind of the surf rock thing, you know. Aside from the fact that it like the recording on YouTube sounded like an already old recording that ended up on the album that we actually listened to, it could be from the 50s, it could be from the 60s, it could be like a retroist thing from the 90s or even from the 2000s. You know, it isn't really placed in the mid 80s. It doesn't sound like any of the other albums. And there's a weird thing as well, because your man is doing the spoken word stuff. Sometimes it sounds like jokes. Sometimes it's like reading from police reports or something.
I had to check if that was the way it was supposed to be, because I was I kept looking to see if there was a different tab playing something that I hadn't realised. I was like, what is that? Because it just goes throughout the whole song.
But I think it's kind of interesting, because it kind of grounds it, like it brings it into a normal, like that's obviously more normal and straightforward, and someone speaking kind of very, you know, clear diction, and then your man going mental over it and singing in the background. Actually, it even separates it even more, you know.
Well, the band got kind of a hard time because, you know, I think Irish people were like, who does this guy think he is, being a rock star? It's like, what, isn't that kind of the point of
totally
some bands?
Point, yeah.
It's totally the point. Like, I mean, I remember them being in the papers because he got dragged off stage by the local parish priest somewhere in Ireland, and I think that's brilliant. Like, it should have happened more, you know.
That kind of weird, though. That kind of weird juxtaposition, like, assuming it is deliberate. It kind of reminded me of the Butthole Surfers here and there. And I mean, even like the overall kind of nature of it, actually, took me back to my youth again, to a non-Limp Bizkit situation, a better one. And I kind of thought about like the Banana Splits theme tune and things like that. Like, it just seemed to be like this completely crazy, raucous, over the top thing that didn't give a shit about being clean or conventional or, you know, like trying to satisfy people. And I really respect this record. I mean, it's a lot of fun to listen to. And once again, I find myself coming back and saying I can see why it wasn't number one in the charts or anything. But they just simply didn't give a shit. And I really, really respect that. I thought it was a great record.
I think it that EP culture, like, it does breed a certain amount of, you know, experimentation, I think, and, you know, just throw it on, that sounds good. Some people might like that, whereas I think with an album, I don't know, I think maybe people overthink albums a lot, whereas EPs maybe
it's interesting
allows you to be freer.
We're kind of returning to a time now when it's probably more useful for bands to go with the sort of drip feed effect of releasing things, because if you release an album now and then you wait another 3 years and you release another album, the publicity cycle doesn't really work for you in that way anymore, because it's all about Twitter and social media and small EPs getting more attention. So if you want that sort of situation where as a band you're just generating a little bit of attention a lot of the time, funnily enough, the EP is actually a more valuable form. And if you look at a band like, say, Ash, I mean, they've kind of realized that, and they've started doing all sorts of unusual routes to kind of, I suppose, releasing.
They're doing like one song a week there for a while,
weren't they? For a little bit, yeah. And you kind of think, why is a band like Ash doing that? They're doing it because they're looking at a new model for the industry, and they're trying to figure out how to stay relevant and stay out there.
What I liked about it was there was an element of actually, the kind of things that the best albums give you is like you're stepping into somebody else's crazy world.
Yeah, totally.
And
yeah,
the female vocals, and you felt like it was a bit of a gang going on. And that's like with some of the best bands, when you do listen to their albums, you do feel like there's something going on like that. And that's what I really liked about it, the energy and the enthusiasm. Yeah. And while it wasn't perfect by any stretch of the imagination, it was really interesting. And I was not aware of them in the first place. So
yeah. And that song, Black Flag, is an absolute belter. I just thought that was brilliant.
So we'll go with a band instead who enjoyed a comeback in recent years after disappearing for quite a while. This is The Blades, and this is The Last Man in Europe. Title track there from The Blades in 1985, and I think we can all agree, you know, it kind of reminds me of that, like, the way it kind of blasts in with just like horns and synths and everything just driving immediately off the cuff in such a kind of a jaunty, upbeat way. It sounds like a game show theme tune, and it reminds me of the Going for Gold theme tune, which I think we can all agree is the best thing Hans Zimmer has ever done in his career.
Going for Gold, the TV show.
Did you know that Hans Zimmer did the theme tune?
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I made a cocktail for Henry Kelly in New York once.
Tell us about that.
And he said it was... So we were staying in the... This is true. We were staying in the Canadian consulate in...
I did not see that coming at all.
When am I ever going to be able to tell a story ever? And he came to stay with his son, who is just the loveliest little fella. And he was talking about, he'd love a drink or something. And I said, well, I can make you a cocktail. I was working at a cocktail barman at the time. And I made him a cocktail, and he said it was one of the nicest cocktails he ever had. And then I never saw him again. Not that I was expecting to see him again.
But. Do you feel like, you know, this is the time to try and reach out to him, perhaps?
Well, me and Henry, you know, I feel like we connected in a way that only game show hosts and, you know, musicians can ever connect.
Wasn't he on Game for a Laugh as well?
Was he?
Game for a Laugh had quite a few presenters, as far as I remember.
I can't say I'm familiar.
No, right.
The Hans Zimmer thing, though, is like it's been brought up before, and he's very much like, it bought me a house. You know, it's fine. He's grand. He's moved on. He's doing different things now.
He's okay, I think.
I think he's doing all right, yeah.
Does he still have the house?
I don't know, but I know that he has an online, you know, learn how to be a producer thing. There's a YouTube trailer for it I saw last week, and it feels like it's a parody, but it's not, because he seems like a crazy person in a good way. Like, it's weird. But nonetheless, the Blades, who precipitate all this strange game show Hans Zimmer talk. Yeah, Last Man in Europe. It's weird, because I found myself in kind of a similar position to Kieran today when I was listening to this, and I was like, I don't want to just say it's a pleasant listen, because it's much more than that, but it is very charming. I think it's a very charming record. And I think, as I say, it comes racing out the blocks with The Last Man in Europe. And it's like, I found myself reading old reviews of this, and the one that was in Hot Press magazine by the late George Byrne is a particularly good read. And you can, the enthusiasm that he had for this record is absolutely gigantic. Like, he makes the point where he says that Paul Cleary of The Blades has such an innate grasp of what constitutes a great pop song that he leaves just about every songwriter in the country standing. Make no mistake, this is pop. And he puts pop in, like, you know, capital letters with an exclamation mark to make the point. He finishes up this kind of part of the review by saying that his choruses are deceptively simple, or simply deceptive, and have that legendary quality of an unidentified recall. You know, why am I singing this song, and what is that song? I've often been kept awake for hours trying to place a particular hook, and I'm afraid Paul Cleary will interrupt my sleep for years to come, which I think is an absolutely beautiful line. And I think it's earned, too. I think that Paul Cleary, in every one of these tracks, has at least one moment where he just blows you away, whether it's with a hook or just a really, really deft line. And there's just so much energy in this, and it manages to be both kind of arresting and upbeat while also dealing with some kind of downbeat subject matter. I mean, a song like Down Market still has relevance in a post-recession world, people where they can't get jobs. And it's kind of one of those, like, they're a very interesting band with an interesting story. They were dropped by two labels en route to this record coming out. It kind of signaled the end rather than the beginning. And they disappeared for many years. Their comeback in 2013 was hailed, and they sold at the Olympia twice, I believe, Pay Electric Picnic after that, and are still kind of doing stuff, still making new music. And it seemed that a lot of people were very, very happy for them to come back. And they are kind of one of those Irish bands that around the time, they were, like, hailed as they're going to be as big as, you know, like, as anybody else. And then, for whatever reason, they just weren't, in U2 kind of rose, while a lot of Irish bands didn't. A lot of people kind of thought of them as the Irish version of The Jam. And even themselves, when they were talking about, you know, U2, like, Paul Cleary is very deferential and says, no, there was never any kind of major beef. You know, we kind of had some mild, immature spats, but overall, you know, we all know who won that battle, he said. So.
Yeah, I don't know. Deferential, I'd, like...
No?
Well, I'd say there's a lot of the story still to be told. And I think the words, you know, generally used about Paul Cleary when he's talking about U2 is that he's a gentleman and he always is very sort of... nice about their success, but if you think about it, the bands were playing on the same bill at times, playing in Dublin, and it must have been a very hard blow for the Blades to see their stars kind of fall while U2's rose. I mean, I think that's just a very hard thing for any band to see. So I think that, you know, they understand how talented they were. So I think that that's probably the harsh point, isn't it? I think sometimes when you can see that your talent doesn't rival another band's, you can kind of say, fair enough, go your own way. And obviously not to take anything from U2, but the Blades, as I think they show on this album, like with a track like Down Market, could actually have gone a great long distance further than they did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a superb track. And I mean, as we say, like, you know, it has that kind of, it's good for the radio. Like, it gets you kind of like, it's very infectious, but it also has commentary. And I don't think it's too didactic either. I think it's just right. And there's lots of tracks in this record that kind of do the same thing. But I mean, they had lineup changes. They obviously had group problems. They snubbed a charity event that was pretty big, Self Aid, in, was it 85 or 86?
85, the time? Yeah.
Which U2 were on that bill, I believe. So, I mean, like, were they very much trying to be iconoclastic and just be like, you know, anti-establishment or whatever? Like, did it cost them? Or was it just a case of some things take off and some things don't?
I guess the hardest thing for them has probably been U2 being mentioned every time they're mentioned. Yeah, and sorry. I mean, I guess it's difficult for sometimes for U2 to hear it, oh, we did this and they didn't. But I think any band that formed in Ireland from the year 1980 to 1995, there's going to be some sort of bridge to U2.
Outside Ireland, like, everyone talks about U2. When we go, when we play, you know, anywhere in the world, they want to talk. Do you want to? How, you know? They want to know what.
Well, I remember being in America, mad, and, you know, talking to a guy from Kansas, and he'd never heard of Ireland. He'd heard of England, but he'd heard of U2. So it's just like, he'd never heard of the country, but knew the band and knew the songs, knew lots of them.
Changing now, though, everyone wants to talk about Conor McGregor or Seamus,
well,
from
true,
WWE.
Yeah. But actually, one of the things I always think about the Blades, and I don't know if this is a fair comment or not, but it's certainly how I perceive it. I think when Bono and U2 were coming out of the traps first, Bono had such a strong sense of self-belief, as did the band. And to some extent, the Blades felt like a more modest proposition. Not that they didn't believe in themselves or their talent, but they might not have pushed it in people's faces in quite the same way. And U2 were very keen to establish themselves in America, which, you know, really sealed their fate as being a global kind of prospect. And I don't think the Blades quite saw their moves in quite the same way. And certainly when it came to things like TV shows and stage shows and that, I mean, Bono was all over it, you know? I mean, he really understood what he wanted to be as a frontman. And I think being a frontman is it's such a huge step to make, you know, from being a singer to actually commanding the stage in that way. And you actually read of, you know, even people like Axl Rose, like, studying other people to try and figure out how to get the moves to really make an impression. And maybe at that point the Blades were simply too modest in their own decisions about what they were going to do to really strike out there. I mean, even if you look at Boyzone appearing on The Late Late Show the way they did with that terrible dancing, I mean, in this kind of iconic thing.
But they still
did it, you know what I mean? They still risked everything. You have to risk. And maybe that was something of a problem.
Well, I don't know. I guess for me, I was listening to that car that album in the car last night, and I hadn't listened to it in a long, long time. But I guess it's just a different ethos. I'm not disagreeing with you, by the way. It was a different ethos. And just wildly, it kind of, as you said, wildly different personalities as well. But it's a super album. It's kind of, I could, you know, sometimes I remember one person said to me, there's too much going on. And I come, well, I don't know about that. Because if you listen to some Arcade Fire albums, there's a lot going on there too. And it works. And I think it works on this album too.
To my shame, I've never listened to any Blades. I know Ghost of a Chance. And I was really surprised that Ghost of a Chance wasn't on it. And then I couldn't really understand as well. I guess I found this, the first couple of times I listened to the album, I just thought it was quite all over the place. You know, but the fourth track in, you got a reggae song.
There's,
you know,
a lot of ska,
five tracks in, you're like, you know, so, and but the last track is sounds like a Spandau Ballet song. And I was just like, what is going on, you know? As I listened to it more, I didn't mind. It's a song called Talk About Listening, and it's kind of reggae, and I wasn't really into that. And there's a song called That's Not Love, which just sounds like the most pop. Like, it's just, I was just surprised by how pop it was, you know, for a, you know, a guitar, Irish guitar band. I just thought it was, I just, without listening to it, I thought it would be something else. But then as it went on, the songs that really stood out to me, like Got Soul, which is like the fifth or sixth song, Down Market, and then Those Were the Days as well. And there's a song called Chase to Stop as well. And I know I just think they're brilliant, you know, but I did think there was a little bit of, I don't know, it's
lack of cohesion.
Yeah, lack of cohesion, but also it kind of felt like a compilation album, and like the best of the Blades sort of thing. I didn't really know why that was either. And then I went back and read their history, and you know, they got signed in 1980. They released a single. 1981, they released a single. Then they got dropped by the label. Then they floated around a bit for a couple of years. Got signed again to Elektra or something. Is that what you said?
Yeah, and then dropped again.
Got dropped again. And then, you know, so I can imagine how that would happen. So I wonder whether the you know, there was a deliberate, you know, maybe push by the label to have more pop stuff in it. I don't know. Like, the best parts of it, though, I absolutely love. And I think these albums, out of all these albums, I can imagine going back to this and, like, letting it, you know, come over me a bit more, like, discover it a bit more. Mm-hmm.
It sounds like a band in a hurry, for sure. Even a track like Don't Break the Silence, you're just kind of like, you can almost imagine yourself closing a door on music notes, kind of like to keep them in the room, because you're just like, Jesus Christ, lads, relax. But I think that's kind of part of the charm. And I guess if they did have so much kind of head up about them, I think they executed it in a very, very good way. Noel, what do you think of this record?
I was not totally familiar with the Blades, to be honest. I was aware of them, so I guess I was surprised by how poppy it was, more than anything else. You know, I always had this impression of this, you know, kind of punky post-punk band that from Dublin, but that's not really what this album is at all. But yeah, definitely, you mentioned the jam earlier on, Style Council. It was kind of what I was thinking of a lot in context of this album, for sure. It's interesting to hear that. Did they come back? They did a reunion tour.
They did an EP last year, which was actually pretty good.
New stuff.
Yeah, it's called Small Time.
That's good.
Actually, he came into my radio show to talk about it, and like, just a lovely, lovely man, really great to see them back on the rise again. And then they played, you were mentioning the Olympia, I think it was, to packed out audience there. And like, they're just one of those bands that got away, you know?
Mm. There's a certain ignorance in our own history in terms of music, and it's not intentional, I don't think. which is why the Revisit podcast is such a good idea, because like, it's hard to find some of these albums, you know.
It's kind of really cool doing homework like in this way, because we're so used to this whole Spotify thing where it's like, you know, we just have everything and everything's available, and then suddenly I was like, I don't know how to get this album, and I was getting really frustrated, you know. And it was, it reminded me of when people talk sometimes about music, when and how they went to certain record shops to get something, and they traveled. And like a friend of mine, when I was growing up, a friend of mine was really into Lenny Kravitz, and when he found out that the new Lenny Kravitz album was out, he drove from Skibbereen to Cork just to get it. He was like, I have to get it. Like, and he came back with it and he was like, I've got it. Like, and it was a 2 hour trip, well, an hour and a half. So, you know, that was the kind of thing people did for music in those days.
We'll move on to our fourth record, which is Micro Disney and The Clock Comes Down the Stairs, which sounds like this.
You're a genius, you're a giant, you're a prince, you are the whole. The things you feel are just a joke, so burn, burn, burn. They filmed your party, you were the center. You had your bottle, you met new people.
Okay, so Micro Disney, Dan Haggerty, tell us all about them.
Yeah, Micro Disney.
I brought the CD with me.
That one of my copies of the CD. But this is anyway. We'll get to this in a minute. No, look, Micro Disney are one of those bands that I remember being name checked a lot, and I remember just going, I don't know this band. And you know, back then, you know, you couldn't, if you didn't have a cassette, a vinyl, or a CD of it, you didn't have it. You just didn't have it. So I didn't have it. It was Keith Cullen from Satanta Records who name-checked them in an article, in an interview once, and I kind of went, must check them out. And then a few other people mentioned them as well. Then I was listening to a band called the High Lamas a bit. They'd released two albums, I Love Hawaii and the one before that, Gideon Gay. And as well, Cathal Coughlan, who's always interested me as a vocalist and scared the bejesus out of me as well. He's a lovely fellow, but I remember interviewing him. He's kind of a really nice guy, very, very interesting. But he just completely, I was terrified until I got talking to him, but he's very nice. Anyway, so Fatima Mansions and Cathal Coughlan stuff as well. And then I found out, oh, these guys were in a band together, and it was Micro Disney. So around that time, it would have been 95, 96, a label called Ravola reissued some of the Micro Disney albums. There was Everybody is Fantastic, the renamed Love Your Enemies, and
it was called We
Hate You South African Bastards. That's what it was originally
We Hate
titled.
You South African Bastards.
Yeah.
That was the title of the album.
That was the title of the album, the original.
What was the reason for that? No.
Well,
in joke,
apartheid, I'd imagine, or something like that. And then there was The Clock Came Down the Stairs. So I started in the order Everybody's Fantastic, Do Like That, and then got to this. And it's kind of, I remember thinking, you know, it was released over 10 years ago because it sounds older to me. It sounds like a pop record. And I was listening to the vocals on it and I just went, they don't sound like vocals that you'd expect to hear on a poppy kind of record. It just sounded a little bit bizarre to me, although I did really, really like it. And it was something that I came across again a few years later when I heard an album by an Australian guy called Ben Lee called Breathing Tornadoes. Again, different type of thing, but again, another vocal that didn't really suit, or I didn't expect to hear gliding along on top of a pop tune. But it's an interesting album. I think there's a lot of people that go, oh, albums are timeless, so therefore they're brilliant. Lots of albums aren't timeless and that are brilliant. I love this. I mean, I kind of get muddled up with a lot of stuff from Micro Disney now. I forget what's on what album. But I know, you know, Birthday Girl and stuff like that.
I'm literally rubbing.
So I can cheat.
The inlay card on this is amazing, by the way. Can I just read you a tiny bit of it? Just goes, The Clock Comes Down the Stairs was recorded arse about face, in so much as the drums were the last thing to be played on it. Most bands will confirm that this is a preposterous way to make a record. Micro Disney were, however, flat broke at the time and could only afford initially to demo the songs with a drum machine. Under the influence of acid, Cahill's mind was behaving unusually, and he'd stopped answering to his own name, concerned that nobody in England could pronounce it. The T in his Christian name is silent. He was now calling himself Blah Blah. It was all shaping up excellently. What a great little
intro, isn't it?
No, it's just a really unusual album, and it's a real little gem. You should listen to it immediately.
I'm
glad you mentioned the vocals, though. Yeah. I found them, I couldn't get past them. I hate that I couldn't get past them. I know it's such a lame criticism, but every now and then there can be a blocker on a record for me, and this was too much for me. I just found it so hard to get through.
Why?
I just thought it was too much. I thought it was too of its time, too abrasive, too... I don't know. It didn't sit right on my ear. And I know, I tried, and I was like, you're going to sound like such a prick.
Yeah, but you shouldn't have to try. If you don't like it, you don't like it.
Couldn't get through it.
I don't think it stands up as well as The Blades, for example. Certainly I found some of the lyrics kind of annoying.
I didn't get into the
lyrics at all.
The cadences.
They just stood out to me.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, when this, I knew this was going to be in there, and I just had a feeling, and because it's just, Micro Disney are one of these bands, you know, kind of way, like, I kind of feel like they're one of those Irish bands. Whenever just someone does a, I don't mean in any negative way about Micro Disney, but someone does a, let's name the top, you know, 50 Irish albums of all time, you know, people just go, right, we need a Micro Disney album, we're going to need some Blades, we're going to need a couple of U2, you know, I can imagine that kind of conversation happening. And I found some of the lyrics meant, like in the first track, again, like the Golden Horde, the first track, I'm not a fan. Horse Overboard, and it goes through it, and then, you know, the reveal of the song is the end, is my wife is a horse, and when he sang that line, I was just like, oh, what's this going to be like, you know? And there'd already been a couple of, you know, like the cadences of some of the phrasings were kind of odd.
Did you find it a bit slapdash in ways?
Well, I've written down...
A bit don't care-ish.
I've unfocused, is one of the things that I have written, unfocused, you know? I think it's quirky. I think it's interesting. Lots of stuff I hadn't heard before. I love all that kind of side of it. I love that it's, you know, he wasn't singing like, you know, your normal singer sings. I like that. I like when people don't, you know, all the lines in a song have to be the same length and hit the four by, you know, hit the bar, you know, at the top of the bar and all that kind of stuff. But I just found it hard to listen to. Now, saying that, the more I listened to it, the more I liked it. But there was just a lot of stuff on it that I wasn't, you know.
I know. I think sometimes when you listen to music and the vocals in particular, you're not quite sure if you like them. Like, I remember the first time I heard The Frames, I went, oh, that guy's got a very unusual voice. And I grew to love Glenn Hansard's vocals now. Same with Kathy Davey. I was listening to her going, she's outstanding. She really is. Kate Bush, someone else as well. I'm not a big, massive Kate Bush fan, but I think her voice is incredible. Well, Cathal Coughlan, his voice was a similar thing. It's like, I don't know really what to make of this, but it kind of grows in you.
Sounds like Squeeze, isn't it? Doesn't it? I just kept hearing Squeeze everywhere.
And for some reason, I thought of the Smiths more with this record than I did with Blue in Heaven. I just got this feel of them wearing, like, I didn't actually Google image them, but I was got the feel of sort of flowery, big, blousy shirts and a sort of disaffected way of dancing.
Well, at the time, they used to get the Hall & Oates comparisons all the time, and I don't necessarily hear that. I think it's probably one of those lazy comparisons because there's two key people in it, but I don't really hear Hall & Oates in that at all. I don't know. Does anyone else?
No, I heard no Hall & Oates. Hall & Oates are so sharp and like almost clinical and precise.
Yeah. My favourite song actually was Money for Trams, the last track. I thought that was, I think it's great. It's spoken, but there's a lot of spoken word. It's really weird. There's a spoken word song called, you know, on the song Genius, where he's like, I am a god, picnic, you know that bit?
I was like, I guess sometimes those albums that are a little bit off the beam of what's happening at the time are the ones that kind of stick with people. Like, I mean, I don't know what I was doing when this was released. Probably nothing particularly interesting because I was quite young, probably wanting to play football for Liverpool or something. But, you know, this and stuff like Horse Drawn Wishes by Roller Skate Skinny, which is entirely different, but it was just different to everything else that was around at the time. They kind of stick in your mind. Because, you know, when I listened to a lot of stuff from this time back many years ago, this for me was different to all the other stuff that I listened to, certainly from Ireland anyway.
I did like this album. I just didn't like it as much as some of the other albums that we listened to, and I was very interested to hear it because I'd heard so much about Micro Disney over the years that to hear them in ways and to hear a song like Birthday Girl and realise that of course I know this song, I've known this song for years, I've just never known that it was or never really connected the dots that it was Micro Disney that were doing it and that this is what they sounded like and this is Cathal Coughlan and Sean O'Hagan, and you know, that I just hadn't put it all together really. But I mean, it was kind of fascinating as almost like a piece of its time as well. It's very of its time.
It feels like the album as art installation, and that's fine. I mean, like, there's obviously, you know, an audience for that. And, you know, even in recent years, some of the Popical Island bands in Dublin would kind of have a similar vibe where it's like meant to sound like you're at a party where, you know, it's all a bit ramshackle. And like, that person doesn't sit great on my own ear. I'm not really into it, but I totally understand why people would be. And as a result, I found myself admiring this more than actually liking it.
I was going to say that exact thing.
Yeah,
I appreciate
it. I said it, so there you go.
Yeah, well, I was going to say it. I said it to your brain.
You can call it a pleasant listen again if you want.
Yeah, it's very nice. No, I think I agree. I appreciate it more than I enjoyed it, I think.
Yeah, which is difficult. I mean, like even like, you know, like you come away from like a film and you're like, oh, I really want to like this more. But I find myself kind of just sitting back and being like, yeah, I see where you're going for. It's kind of like, you know, it's like a party that I wouldn't necessarily want to go to. But, you know. Maybe I'd talk to the people after the party or something.
Yeah.
We're going with this.
You might name check the party and say, oh, yeah,
I
put
was
that
there.
In the. Yeah.
I was there, but you weren't really.
Yeah, I'll check in.
I think we said something
similar.
You're
at home listening to Limp Bizkit.
Let it go. They have two good songs, right? Let's be honest now. Rearrange.
Well, you can say the name now. Go on.
Rearrange is a great track. Like, I mean, like, that's a really impressive Limp Bizkit song. You know, if you're gonna go deep on Limp Bizkit.
And leave all this stuff in.
You can give him a special Limp Bizkit Revisit podcast.
Okay, so Paul Brady, Back to Center, is our final record of the evening, and it sounds like this.
I want to take you to the island and trace your footprints in the sand, and in the evening when the sun goes down, we'll make love to the sound of the ocean.
So Paul Brady, a contentious figure, not for Nadine O'Regan.
Oh, no, he is a contentious figure. And we were just talking about, I suppose, songs that maybe the man in the street wouldn't whistle along to. And you see, Paul Brady is the opposite of this. And when everybody was picking their album that they would talk about in this podcast, I was late to the party and... I got the email from Kieran going, oh, you know, Micro Disney is gone and Blue in Heaven is gone and the Blades are gone. And I was like, oh, yeah, I know it's coming. I've got Paul Brady. So everyone else is going to look 10 times cooler than me. However, right, I'm going to say this, right? I actually love Paul Brady. And I love Paul Brady in the way that I also love Phil Collins. And not because it's becoming retrospectively cool to like either of those figures, but because when I was small, my dad used to play music in the car all the time. And that was kind of one of the ways I first got introduced to music. So he played music on tapes, and his tapes were things like Fleetwood Mac, Phil Collins, and Paul Brady. So actually, Back to the Centre is an album that not only do I know, but I know incredibly well because he only had a finite number of tapes in that car. And we used to listen to it absolutely all the time. So for me to hear the album again, you know, it was funny because initially I was like, oh, is that one of the albums I know? And then I was like, not only do I know it, I know all the words. I know what was on the first side and the second side. And for me, it has this amazing quality to it because it actually is a real driving album. It's a real on the road album. If you listen to the production, it's very, very smooth. Eric Clapton is one of the guests on this album.
Yeah.
Larry Mullen is also in there. And Loudon Wainwright actually is also
in there. I saw that
in
the credits. I was like,
yeah, because kind of Paul Brady is quietly a phenomenal musician, whether you like or dislike his shtick or his maybe a tendency towards, I suppose, a kind of an emotional reach that not everybody's going to get along with, and he's certainly not the coolest figure in music. He's somebody who is a fine musician. And the thing about this album is that it has these kind of very, very velvety grooves that you can fall into, whereas the other albums that we're talking about in the list, they're kind of difficult and wayward in their way. They are cool and they're hip. This is not a cool or a hip album, but what it does have is it has a sense, in the same way that Tom Petty has a sense, of just this very true and comfortable quality. And Paul Brady, almost all the time through this album, he's hiding his own sort of melancholic, his natural tendency towards a more melancholy vibe. And there's a line actually on, I suppose, the most famous track on the album, where The Island, where he says, "This wasn't meant to be no sad song." And I feel like that's his modus operandi for most of what he does. He's actually almost in his essence a very melancholic musician, similar to Van Morrison actually in that respect, but he's always disguising it with very bright grooves and a very, very comfortable production. So you might feel as though you're being carried along, but then always all the time there's these flecks of misery coming to kind of poke at you and say, well, actually, he's a very sad man. I think that from that perspective, for me, he makes for a very interesting listen. And then there's also, of course, the genre mixing. I mean, he was a member of Planxty for a while. He was coming from a trad background. He decided to move into a pop direction. And then he became somebody who really, for a time, could have been absolutely enormous. I mean, he was and is a very big musician. I mean, he's one of the only people that we're talking about here that can actually walk onto the Late Late Show, sit down and be interviewed as a guest. And that is just a fact. And there is a reason for that. You know, he's somebody who at a certain point could have gone close to Elton John in terms of his actual stature as a musician. And actually he talks in an interview about how his mother was very disappointed that he didn't get to the Elton John kind of level, and she used to kind of wonder about it, and she'd say, you know, do you think that maybe you weren't as good a piano player? And I mean, yeah. Of course, a lot of it does boil down to personality. I think he has, as I was saying, a very sort of complicated personality, and I think that's reflected in some of the lines and the lyrics. But yeah, I mean, for me, look, I mean, he's of a piece in my mind with the likes of Robert Palmer, or actually there's some echoes of Tom Petty there as well. I have no issue with middle of the road rock. I love alternative music, but I love stuff that's so middle of the road it's practically got two white lines.
Yeah, well, I mean, back nearby. To the centre. I mean, it's
if it sounds good, like a subtitle for middle of the road.
It is.
But I nearly think that without being. God, I keep saying I don't want to be unfair, but like,
be
take those gloves off.
Go on.
Well, no, I just because
I
want to be fair to all the albums, but I mean, this is so middle of the road for me. Mm. But actually, you know something, it's not bad as a result of it. I mean, this is my first ever Paul Brady album, and I can't believe that it's got The Island on it, which is the only probably song that I knew of his. But it does kind of sound like it could be. So I've written down a few songs could have been used in 80s detective videos.
Do you know what they could have been as well, right? You know, Mannequin came out in like 1987.
Yeah, totally.
And actually, if you think of, now this track isn't on it, Nobody Knows, but if you actually listen to Nobody Knows, it's actually a synth-led track, and it's very, very floaty and effortless feeling. And actually, if Paul Brady looked different, if he acted differently, if he slightly orientated his music differently, there would have been a very kind of different audience for his music.
I fully agree. I think, you know, if his personality was a lot more boisterous, as some of his writing can be, like, I mean, I've heard him interviewed, and like even kind of like, you know, like in some kind of more kind of intimate settings, and it's not so much that he sounds resentful. But I wonder if he is resentful, because there's definitely that thing. There's like, why there was a glass ceiling for him for whatever reason, and I don't think he believes that there should have been. But I do agree with you that it comes down completely to, you know, you mentioned earlier on the idea of a frontman versus a lead singer, and I think, you know, in that aspect, for him to jump into be this kind of household name and this big massive thing, he needed to wear it more on himself, and for whatever reason, just can't. I suppose
I always got the impression of Paul Brady as a songwriter first. Yeah. As opposed to a frontman.
Yeah.
And for me, I mean, he's just been omnipresent throughout my entire life, so I never really questioned him.
Sound like a really bad thing.
You know, he's just there. He'd be like, he'd be on the Late Late or whatever.
Yeah.
He'd be there when you were younger on the beatbox or something like that. You know, he'd be just be there.
Was
like,
he one
Paul
of the people
was there.
When you were walking your dog that asked about the records that you were doing?
No, because you know, like you say, Paul Brady has a much bigger name than most of those artists.
Yeah.
So that's why I didn't ask them about Paul Brady. You know,
I would.
My
never.
Dad has a Paul, like a best of Paul Brady collection. So I know, so he's just, know, like a musician who's been there for years to me.
I would never put him in the same sentence as Elton John. I don't mean that as an insult to either of them. I'd always think of him more in a Van Morrison type. Mm.
Yeah.
Songwriter, exactly. You totally summed him up for me. He is a songwriter and a singer, but incredible as well. I'm not too familiar with this album, but I know lots of his songs, and you know, whether I love them all is debatable, but I love some of them.
Well, this track, the second track, "Wheel of Heartbreak," I was so surprised by how that was great. You know
that name, though, man.
Wheel. Well, see, this
like
is the thing.
Your own adventure novel. Like,
no, but this is the thing about Paul Brady, and there's a thing in Ireland. There's a, you know, a lot of people can write melodies, and a lot of people can write lyrics, and but not a lot of people can write melodies and lyrics. And some of Paul Brady's lyrics, some of them, not all of them, some of them, every now and again, can be a little bit like, you know, a little bit, you know, middle of the road. They can be a little bit sort of
back to the center.
Back, you know, sometimes they can be a little bit like, you know, what's the phrase? Like, we're making love, facing the ocean spray or whatever it was, you know, and I'm kind of going, you know, I don't know. I just, there's a bit of that. But at the same time, it takes a skill for you not to care about that because, you know, your melodies are good and your, you know, your harmonies, your musical harmonies are good. And he's very good at that. It's, he's got a lot of skill throughout this. And sometimes it's modelling and sometimes it's like there's a lot of money in the production here, you know.
Oh, there's so much money.
Like I was thinking, because the blades, the keyboard sounds and it can sound like fairly, some of the blade stuff sounds quite cheap.
Do you know what's lovely about this, though, is to, yeah, and about certain things like this, you can get someone like Nadine sitting here, and she loved it when she was a kid. Okay, maybe you didn't love it as a kid. Maybe you loved aspects of a kid, but all these years later,
it's
you
hard
can
to
still,
separate the two.
You can still appreciate it. And is that not the essence of a really fine album?
Well, I just like, I'm not saying, I'm actually surprised by how good I found the album. Is kind of my point. What I was getting to, like, you know, it's very, very easy to listen to. It's very polished. It's very smooth. I think you said all those things, you know.
And
it's
also, I found it a very pleasant listen.
I found it a very pleasant listen. No, but not even that. Like, all I found right. it. I'm not being challenged by this in the way that perhaps I was being by maybe the Golden Horn.
Of course not. It's a Paul Brady record.
I know, but the thing about it is that I can imagine totally, like, I can imagine generation, like, you know, parents in cars with kids and, you know, grandparents
and mortgages and things to worry about
and like it being absolutely
Paul is speaking to them, but he's not interfering with the smooth groove that Eric is helping him with.
More importantly, at the time, did he own a fax machine? That's what I want to know.
Who knows? But one thing I actually did want to say about it is I thought it was interesting that the Blue Nile's A Walk Across the Rooftops, an album I really loved, came out in 1984. And I actually felt like that you could hear elements of the Blue Nile threaded through the Paul Brady sound if you were looking for it. Again, slightly disguised by the context and the kind of velvety vibe to it and the money that's been poured into it. But they're not as far apart as they might initially seem.
I never even thought of that, but yeah, you're spot on. I mean, like, but I feel like a song like The Downtown Lights is streets above something like The Island.
Yeah, well, you see, the
now,
thing is,
they're
right,
very different.
Okay, the thing I love about the Blue Nile, right, is that I suppose they have this way about them where they're so insecure and unsure and everything is sort of an open question and they're sort of comfortable within that. They're sort of telling you all the time that they're sort of shy, but they're also on the stage and they're introverted, but they're doing something very extroverted. And fundamentally, the contradictions inherent in the Blue Nile is what I think most people love about them, that they're so kind of complicated. And in a very strange way, there's aspects of Paul Brady that, to my mind, bring that up as well. Because, like I said, he's miserable, but he's providing you with these upbeat and bouncy elements, and he's disguising it. So you're actually getting more than you think.
The Island, though, how do we feel about that in general as a song that's often hailed as one of the greatest ever written by some people? I had a friend of mine listen to it, actually, and he noted that, I just want to write this down to give him the records of credit, he said, it sounds like Don McLean playing Candle in the Wind on the piano in the bar that Cheers was shot in. And I was like, I can see that.
It's too much for me, The Island. Like, I mean, I get it as like an absolute kind of massive part of his sound, but I suppose it's one of those ones that's kind of passed into, like, it is Candle in the Wind sort of territory. And I think I probably am a little bit too much to the left of that to be able to completely embrace it. It was actually the other songs on the album that I was responding to more. A lot of people like middle of the road stuff. And I'd also say that a lot of people like hamburgers. And a lot of the time you want to go and eat some interesting food and whatever. And then sometimes you just want a burger. And there's nothing wrong with that. If Paul Brady is the burger, that's fine.
That's an analogy. The imagery of this is
like right.
Right. Okay.
Is that the time?
It's time to try and pick a winner from this bunch. We'll take a break and we'll come back and we'll do just that. Okay. Let's try and decide what is worth a revisit. Whether there's more than one, we will find out. We'll start with Niall.
I'm going to pick the one that I was championing, I guess, the Golden Horde, just because it's a curious album. It's a unique album. It's got it doesn't even sound like an Irish album. Like I said, it's a mix of punk and surf pop and all sorts of weird stuff. Ramones, B-52s, and that really appealed to me as something that was very different. Where you can kind of get a sense where some of the other albums like Blue in Heaven and The Blades and Micro Disney, that there's pressure there from like to deliver an album. And the Golden Horde just sounds like somebody was having a great time. And I think anyone can get that can rub off on the listener as well. So the Golden Horde.
That's a good argument, Nadine.
So I'm going to go with Blue in Heaven with All the God's Men, because it was an album that I had never heard a thing from before. Didn't really know anything about the band other than what I then went and researched. And I really liked the way I felt that it could sit alongside a lot of the contemporary stuff I'm listening to. And yeah, it was really catchy, you know, like little, and they sounded like they meant it as well. I mean, I know I was talking about Paul Brady there, but I mean, people know Paul Brady and I don't think he needs any more discovery on that perspective. And I very much like, for example, The Blades as well. But as a discovery for me, Blue in Heaven would be the one.
All right, Dan?
Well, there's no point in me really saying Micro Disney, is there? Because everyone kind of said it was kind of, oh, I like that, and then they dissed it. Discovery, like, oh god, I'd probably be Golden Horde Blades, the Blades a little bit more so, because I totally agree with what you're talking about, but I suppose I've listened to Blades a little bit more in the last couple of days, so I'm a little bit more drawn to it. I just kind of think there's an energy about it. Yes, okay, I do get the point that someone made earlier on, that there's a few things and I go, oh, that's strange, that's on it does sound a little bit like certain songs were put on there as well. Maybe there's not a theme, but I suppose you don't. We don't know what the pressures and the constraints of the band were at the time. But as a bunch of songs, yeah, I think it's a pretty strong album.
Yeah, I'm kind of torn between Golden Horde and The Blades as well. I think Niall's recommendation is very, very strong. I would pick The Blades, though, over them, simply because I do think that it's a very good story, and I do think it's a great record that shouldn't be overlooked. And I think, you know, in looking at where the story might go, I think this is quite a good, not so much first chapter, but if you've never heard of them before, it should be your first chapter, so I would go The Blades. Kieran?
I could vote for any of Blue in Heaven, The Golden Horde, or The Blades as an album to go and to visit, you know, for people who don't know any of those albums. I think the album, though, that I think for me I could probably recommend the most out of this list is probably The Blades, I think, with a half a vote for the Golden Horde and half a vote for Blue in Heaven as well.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's obviously a recommendation situation where, like, you know, you don't need to just pick The Blades, but I guess, you know, it garners most. I think the fact that, like, albums cropped up here that I never, like, the Golden Horde, I never heard it before, even on my first listen I was like, yeah, it's not really pulling it together for me, but it does.
That's certainly something I like about it, yeah. Is that I didn't know anything about it, I'd never heard about it before, and the title is great as well.
It jumps out.
Chocolate Biscuit Conspiracy.
Okay, well, so, I mean, you know, so I think it's our recommended album to revisit for this show is The Blades.
It's The Blades. Well done, lads. I expect we'll be in their liner notes for the next record, should it actually come about. Awesome. Okay, well, we'll have The Blades play us out. And first of all, I want to say thank you to everyone for coming in. It's been a very fun hour in which I got to be ridiculed once again over my new metal leanings from years past, while also getting into some good new music.
So are you disowning Limp Bizkit?
I can never fully disown your first love.
By the way,
is
that your Crazy Town album over there? Actually,
they're playing. By the way.
Yes.
By the time this podcast comes out, they may have already played. But yeah.
Amazing.
Okay, that does the revisit for this week. We'll be back to you again pretty soon and play us out The Blades and Down Market.
But just before we play that song, Kieran got Paul Cleary from The Blades on the phone for an interview.
How are you, Paul? This is Kieran giving you a shout from No Encore. And the revisit. So we're delighted to say that Last Man in Europe was our album that we're recommending people to have a listen to. And I just wanted to have a quick chat with you about how you feel about it and all that kind of stuff.
Sure.
I think the first thing to say was it seemed like it was a long kind of lead up to it. There seemed to be a little time between the previous singles, and then the album came out. Was that the case for you, or was it a lot of messing, or how did it feel?
I remember, it's like, this is now what, February 2017, and so, you know, it was made in 1984, so it is a long time ago. What's that, 33 years ago? Yeah, we made this a couple of singles. Like, when we started in 1977, you know, with no idea, we played the first gig in 70 with no idea of getting a record deal or anything like that. We started to get a crowd around 79, locally in Dublin, and you know, there weren't that many bands around, really, so we were one of the bands who were talked about maybe getting some sort of a record deal. A record deal in those days could mean like a couple of singles and stuff, but that's, you know, that was great for us. That's all. That was the height of our ambition, really. So we signed for a label called Energy Records in England, and made a couple of singles for them. And then they dropped us. I think they were a subsidiary of Polydor. So we were left then. And then we made a single for over here, just for Ireland. And we made a couple of singles. So we weren't really thinking of making an album. We were always hoping that somebody would sign us for an album. But I'd nearly given up hope at that stage, you know, which was around 1983. I believe we played Listu and Varna. I think it was the last time. It was the big Listu and Varna Festival. Rory Gallagher played and Christy Moore. And Van Morrison, actually, I think. And so we played that. And at that gig was a guy called Andrew Lou Goldham, who used to manage, very famous guy, really. He was used to manage and the Svengali of the Rolling Stones. And he was a talent scout for Elektra, who were the E and WEA, Elektra Records. Mm. And I think he was asked to sign four or five bands worldwide. And he came to see us, and he signed us to Elektra in an international deal. And we thought this was a great thing altogether. So we went to the studio in Wood Green, Livingston Studios in Wood Green in London, 1984, the year of the miners' strike, I remember that, and with John Porter produced it, who was the Smiths producer. And I think he was in Roxy Music for a while too, and that was great. So I suppose we were in our own bubble when we were making the record. As I said, I remember the miners' strike. I mean, I still am quite left-wing, and certainly even more so then, and I was really hoping that the miners would win, and of course Thatcher defeated them in the end. He broke my heart, I suppose. But yeah, that's what I remember about. But with no real idea, clear on, you know, when you're making an album, you've made a few yourself. Once you get into that sort of studio bubble, it's very hard really to know how it's going or what way it will be received, or, you know, how well it will be received or how badly.
Yeah, yeah.
As it happened, we released it. It didn't even get worldwide released. There were changes then, the dreaded record company changes at the top, mm-hmm. and so it never seen the light of day. I think new people came in Elektra, and you know, they wanted to dispense with this Dublin band that nobody had heard of. So yeah. We never got out of the starting blocks, which was bitterly disappointing at the time. And so we just released it in Ireland because our worldwide contract didn't even include Ireland, because I suppose they thought it wasn't worth bothering with, you know. So we were able to release it here, and it was well received here, because we're always reasonably well received in Ireland and our own country, you know. So
it seems like a kind of eclectic. It feels like at times there's lots of different styles going on. You know, there's a bit of soul, there's a bit of mod stuff. There's a bit of jam in there, I suppose, at the mm-hmm. time. That thing. And you know, there's a British sound, and then there's also a bit of an American sound. And that's mm-hmm. you know, is that because lots of the songs were from different eras? You know, I know there was a couple of slight lineup changes. Was it because there was lots of songs from this different times, or did it all just come together and that's the way you wanted to put it together?
Well, I suppose that's the way I wanted to put it together, but really, I mean, that's possibly the reason why we never, in inverted commas, made it, you know, because we had too many styles. But I always like playing reggae. There's a couple of sort of reggae songs on it, and I've always liked playing reggae. We started to do it in rehearsal. I just used to feel it was just a great music to sort of to jam to. I never really liked jamming sort of fast music, rock music, or blues music, but obviously like reggae, you sort of get into a hypnotic groove and you're playing it. So we used to do that a lot for hours and rehearsal. And I just used to really love reggae, and I liked the old Jimmy Cliff stuff. I liked Bob Marley, and I liked UB40, and I liked Ken Booth, and all that stuff. And, you know, so there's reggae on it, there's a bit of soul, a bit of, it's called pop rock. But that's what I like. I like Motown music. I also like the Beatles. I like the Jam, Clash, the Pistols. That's who influences. So there's too much. There we may be too many influences there, possibly. And, you know, some people like the record because of that, because it's not identifiable. You can't be easily pigeonholed as such, you know. But I suppose it's harder to categorize and pigeonhole. That's why maybe people that elect, or maybe the new people decide, look, how do we market this? It's not straight rock. It's probably a bit too hard and edgy for pop. It's certainly not reggae. There's only a couple of reggae songs. So you're right. I mean, your assessment is correct that it is. There's quite a large, it's quite a wide range of styles on it, you know. Yeah. I was just hoping that my voice, and because the band, because we played on it, that would sort of sync the whole thing together as such, you know.
On repeated listens, it definitely does. But, I mean, there's some real standout songs on it, like stuff like Got Soul and Down Market.
Yeah.
You know, really jump out, and they really stand. I mean, I presume you still play those kind of songs, yeah? Or?
We do. We played the Academy there last December. We played, we opened the set with the Last Man in Europe, and we didn't do Got Soul. We did Got Soul the Olympia last year. No, we did. We still did the Last Man in Europe, and we still do a good few songs, Down Market, and another couple of songs on that album. Those Are the Days as well. And as well as that, I suppose, take this opportunity to plug our new album, Modernized, which we released December there last year, which is, you know, it's our first studio album since the Last Man in Europe. And again, there are lots of different types of music on it, but I think it's even more identifiable to play, ironically, than the Last Man in Europe, but there you go. But yeah, the Last Man in Europe was, like, because I was reading a lot of George Orwell at the time as well, and he was, you know, when he wrote... 1984. He wrote that in 1948, and the working title was The Last Man in Europe. So not a lot of people know that, as they say. So I just thought it was a nice title because I wrote the thing in 1984, and because of the miners' strike and so on, that I'd call it The Last Man in Europe. And as it happened, it was released here in 1985. But so that was the key to that, writing it recording in 1984, and The Last Man in Europe being the working title for 1984, the George Orwell's book. So that was that, really. And you know, the song, I suppose, itself, The Last Man in Europe, I suppose it's sort of apocalyptic or post-apocalyptic, and that's what that was to be about. I mean, funnily enough, when I read the lyrics of some of my songs, I don't know about yourself, I sometimes don't even know what they're about, you know. I'm sure I did when I was writing them, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, I mean, the lyrics are, there is definitely I suppose a left wing kind of buzz on a lot of the songs, you know, and Down Market it comes across especially, I think, and that's a bit of an anthem for that kind of, you know, that kind of feel. I know you were heavily against sort of stuff like Live Aid or Self Aid, was it?
I'm glad I was against it, really, because Self Aid seemed to me it was just a big backslapping thing, really. I'm sure that the intentions were honourable in some people who were involved in the organisation, and indeed some of the bands. I mean, some bands were definitely apolitical. Some bands knew what they were doing and just jumped on board, I think. But I never liked the idea of it anyway. I mean, I just think it was, you know, it was basically for employment, and that's what it was. I mean, I think it's up to the government not to provide all the jobs, but they certainly would have to make good the climate that jobs would be there, and they certainly could provide some jobs. But to leave it to charity, I mean, it reached its day there for me, I think, later on that day in the phone-in where Ronald McDonald came in and said there were some jobs available in McDonald's. As if there wasn't all the time, you know. And so, look, I think that whole thing was a bit of a mess, to be honest, and I'm sort of glad I stayed away from it. I mean, I did a Rock the System gig for... what was then Militant Readers of the very left wing, I was going to say part of the Labour Party, certainly would be, had some sort of affiliation to the Labour Party. And that's who I was with at the time. I suppose their legacy now would be the likes of Paul Murphy and so on. Mm. So that's who I was really, that's who I played a gig for in Liberty Hall. We did when they were Rock the System gig, I suppose, was in opposition to Self-Aid, really, you know.
So around that time, I think that was, now correct me if I'm wrong, but it was around 1986, I think, that you broke up.
Yeah.
That's right. And then you got back together in like 2013, I think, is that right?
Yeah, I did a solo album, Crooked Town, in 2001 or 2002, and We played a couple of gigs then, but it wasn't really the Blades. It was just under my own name, although it was most of the band. But yeah, I got the band back together. I played a gig in 2013 for Phil Shevin of the Radiators and the Pogues, the late Phil Shevin, the late, great Phil Shevin, who had this great idea, I suppose, of having a memorial gig for himself while he was still alive. You know, he knew he was dying of cancer. And it was a very brave and great idea of Phil's to have this concert where everyone would sing one of their own songs, one of his songs. And, you know, he asked me to do it, and reluctant as I was, I hadn't really played live properly for years. I was really quite nervous. And it was a full Olympia, not to see me, I might add, because Paul Brady and Damien Dempsey and the bigger guys than me, and some more popular guys than me, were playing. But so I got out on stage very nervously and slashed away at an electric guitar, and I went down reasonably well. And it just gave me confidence, and I remember thinking, God, maybe I could get the band back together. I always liked the Olympia. I'm playing the Olympia, you know. So I got someone to make a few calls to MCD on my behalf, and it was around August or September, and they said, yeah, you play a gig 2013. And I thought, well, we've bitten off more than we could chew here. We haven't played for a long, long time. And lo and behold, we sold out the gig, and we sold out two nights. I couldn't believe it. I mean, I thought we were really going to be pushed to sell out one. We sold out two nights in 2014. I couldn't believe it. And that's how much, I suppose, and I'm really much appreciated by me and the band. That's how much we were still liked by the people that they were willing to go out and buy tickets to see us, you know.
Yeah,
and
no,
that was great, really.
It's a great album, though. It's kind of stood this test of time. But just on that, like, so I guess, When you look back at that album, would you, if you ever put it on or whatever, I don't know whether you do or not, you know, I don't know if I ever put our albums on very often. I can't imagine you do either. But, you know, it might go on. Would you listen back and think, oh, I should have done that or I should have done this? Or, you know, how do you feel about it now?
I don't know. I possibly would have now, Ken, to be honest. I mean, I'll ask you if I probably won't be around in 30 years' time, but somebody will ask you in 30 years' time what you think of your albums. And I think it'll be so far removed from what's going on today, you'll be nonplussed, you'll be scratching your head looking for an honest answer, you know. But I think a few years later, I suppose, when I would listen to it occasionally or I'd hear something, I would then think I should have, you know, maybe I should have left that out or I should have put that in. I think most people, whether they be, you know, filmmakers or poets or, you know, painters, artists, I think when we create art and when we create something, you know, we do our best at the time, and that's what we feel, and we embellish it with how we feel it should be embellished and so on. And of course we change ever so slightly, and therefore our ideas and vision of what good art is changes. So yeah, I think our opinions change, like, you know, our opinions on most things. And so yes, I would have, a couple of years later, hearing some stuff, I would have thought genius. But now, I suppose, it's gone full. I'm happy to be too strong a word, but I'm certainly proud of it. I think it's an album I stand over. It's an album of songs. I'm proud of the songs. I think we recorded them reasonably well. I thought we played very well, particularly Jake Riley, our drummer, I think, you know. He was slightly nervous going in to do a full album because he's very modest, Jake. He's a cracking drummer. He's so good. I mean, he's even got better with age, but when he went in, he was a bit nervous about doing the whole album, but really, he really stepped up to the plate, as they say, and he played really well on it, you know. And I am proud. I think it's a great album, and I feel privileged and thanks that you chose it for that year. I'm not sure what our competition was that year for albums.
Well, I'll tell you if you want. Maybe you know some of the other bands. Blue in Heaven was one of the bands. All the Gods Men, The Golden Horde, The Chocolate Biscuit Conspiracy. We had Micro Disney, The Clock Comes Down the Stairs, and Paul Brady, Out to the Centre.
We're certainly in good company there with most of those bands, you know. Oh, that's great. Now, look, it's very. People do still talk about the album, and you know, not a lot of people. Some people do, you know. I have things in perspective. Yeah. Some people still talk about it. When they do, there's nobody, like, most people have nice things to say about it. They all have a favorite track, whether it be Down Market or Got Soul or Talk About Listening or even The Fast When a Chance to Stop. I think it was.
That's a great one. Yeah, it was one of my favorites.
Yeah, it's a good pop song. I think a lot of people like that one too. So, you know, when we were making it, we did imagine that it would be sold worldwide, and you know, we thought we were taking it up a level. We had played in Dublin and Ireland and you know, England for a few years, and thought, well, we're going to the next stage now, you know. So it really is, I have very mixed emotions about it. I have good memories of making the album, the actual creative work and the singing and the playing guitars, and I remember playing electric guitar, and I, you know, I had a huge big stack of amplifiers, and particularly on that track, The Last Man in Europe, I was crashing the cards. It just felt great, you know. And then, as I said, the album we put on hold, we were getting calls that, oh, maybe might be released now, away for another month. And we all just started, I started to really realise that, look, this is going south very quickly, you know. And that's really disappointing when you're, I don't know, 23, 24 years of age, you know. You know, you sort of think you're on your way, and then you're told, sorry, son, you know.
Well, you came out with a great album, and congratulations.
Oh, well, thanks. And yeah, and it is something, to, when you do something that you're reasonably proud of, people can't take that away from you, you know. And it is nice to be talking about, it's, as I said, in 2017, it's nice to be talking about an album that we made in 1984, you know. It really is, and better late than never. Although a lot of people did say it was a good album. It got reasonably well reviewed, even in the English music papers, you know. So, and they didn't really know about the Blades. It was U2 they knew about, obviously, you know. But
so you've got a new album out now.
A new album, modernised, yeah. Yeah, we'd be playing. We can't do too many gigs. We don't really have the following to do too many, but we can do a few, you know. So we'll be doing one of the summer festivals, I'm sure, and possibly one or two others, and certainly we'll be doing a gig around December of 2017. I'm really not sure of which ones we're doing yet. I'm still talking to MCD about all that, you know. But look, we really enjoy playing, and we have a great crowd, and they really are supportive, and they, you know, well, we really do have a good time at the gigs, as do they, and it's just great. It's great to be able to play again, and we wouldn't be able to do it if the people didn't want us to. It's a cliche, but if they don't buy the tickets, come and see us, we don't play anymore. You know, so it's great, really. I never thought that we'd get a second bite out of it. Yeah, it's great, you know. And the band, particularly Jake and Brian, are really enthusiastic. They're like, you know, they haven't aged. Not only in their mind, but they put me to shame. Like they haven't really aged that much physically either, you know. So, yeah. And they're able to do it. You know, playing bass, guitar, and drums, they're very physical things, really, particularly drums, you know. And Jake and Brian, they're really super fit, really, you know. Well, anyway, go on.
I was going to say thanks very much for talking to us. It's been an absolute pleasure. And congratulations again on the album, and look forward to the new stuff. And sure, we'll see you around.
Okay. Thanks, Kieran.
Thanks very much, Paul. Cheers.
Bye.
Yeah. This podcast is part of the Headstuff Podcast Network.
Buying a home can feel like navigating uncharted waters. Redfin agents can help. They'll answer your questions with honest advice so you know exactly what you're getting into. They'll also help you tour as many homes as you want and show you what it takes to make a winning offer. With a Redfin agent on your side, you can sail straight to your dream home. Local expertise from Redfin. That's real estate done right. Tour subject to property and agent availability. Virginia Office Falls Church, VA 844-759-7732.